I think one of the most misunderstood things about courage is what the opposite of courage is. You know, we have heard for so long that the opposite of courage is cowardice. And that is such a shame-based word that was derived to really get people motivated in a shame-based way to do things that's not natural.
You're listening to Menders with clinical psychologist and leadership consultant, Dr. Nicola DePaul. Each week, get a dose of real-world inspiration from free-thinking leaders, top clinicians, healthcare innovators, and myself. Looking for quick fixes or standard management tools? Try someplace else. Motivated to maximize the resilience and diversity of your team, sustain your momentum as a leader, and transform your healthcare system? Welcome to Menders. Welcome back to Menders. Today, I am so delighted to have Dr. Lucy Houghton with me. And Lucy, you are a woman of many talents, and I'll just highlight a few things. But you're a registered nurse, you're a women's courage researcher, you're also a board certified coach or wellness coach, and you're the founder of wildroots.com, which I'm going to invite you to share a little bit more about, and I'll link to that in the show notes so folks can find you. But you also have a PhD in organizational leadership and human performance, and you've done some really interesting research in this women's courage area, which is really one of the reasons that I invited you to share with me, because you really come from both directions, having the research lens, the on-the-ground, frontline nurse lens. And a fun fact about you, you shared with me that you were a certified athletic trainer for Olympic athletes, which is quite something. So, but I also wanted to share that you have shared with me that your mission is to ensure that women have the training, tools, and support they need to claim their courage and create the life of their dreams. And that really resonates with me. So anyway, so welcome. Thank you for being here. And maybe you can just share about yourself.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me here. You know, for me, I grew up as a farm kid, and which is such a beautiful, incredible experience that it shaped me in such a way to really observe life in all different stages and the ways that that we grow, and really was able to explore in big ways and really harness courage, which was, for me, it was one of my primary, and still is, one of my primary values, but I didn't know that at the time. So my parents were always saying things to me like, "You're so wild." and that's just grown, but they always encouraged it, and they were always there in support of my wildness. And so I think, you know, just when I think about me, I think about those really primary things that shaped who I am, that's led me to the place where I am today, and studying women's courage and naming my business Wild Roots, which, you know, is like shared or spelled a little differently, WYLDROOTZ. But it comes from that place of my parents always saying, like, you know, she's wild. And it's like, yes, because my wildness shows up in my courage. And then that rooted part is really in how we get rooted in our values, clarity in our purpose. And that helps us to move forward in our dreams. And that's, you know, that's really what I'm here to stand for now, is standing in the gap for women who maybe haven't found their wild roots, and how do they do that? And, you know, I often refer to myself as a courage cartographer, and that, you know, map making, because it's not that I have it all figured out and I don't need that map. I do need that map. And so, you know, walk alongside But recognizing that we all need a map sometimes to find our way and to really summon the courage so we can live the life we want to live.
Oh, thank you. That's beautiful. I have a lot of questions that came up for me there, but I think the first question that I had is just, wild is not always perceived in our culture as a good or beautiful thing. How did you come to claim that in such a beautiful and empowering way?
I would say that I didn't always see it that way either. In fact, it took me a long time to see it that way. When I thought as an adult, as a young adult, when I thought back to my parents describing me as wild, I thought that that meant unruly and misbehaving. And that was a bit of a struggle at first when I saw it that way. But it's just like the, you know, one of the first tools that I teach in my, I have a 9-month Women Braving Leadership program. And one of the very first tools that I teach is this name, reframe, and claim process of how we can shift those, you know, maybe unwanted identities into things that we can love. So we don't divorce our story. We don't divorce any part of ourselves, that we can really love all of the parts of ourselves and move those parts forward in a way that's really healthy and useful in moving, you know, towards wherever it is that we want to go. And so I really had to do that. I had to just name it. I feel like this was misbehaving or unruly, or that was the message. And then I reframed it by looking at the way that my parents supported me. The way that they supported me never gave me those messages. And I think even if they had, where I look at where courage shows up in my life, it is intentionally to do the right thing. And so when I reframe it and think, you know, courage is so important in the world, and we look at where it shows up and why it's there, it's like there's nothing unruly about this. It's a very deliberate choosing of what's right in the face of risk, uncertainty, and emotional exposure. That's the definition of courage. And so then I was able to claim that by just reframing, shifting, and thinking back to, you know, what have these experiences really taught me about who I am? And so now I own it.
Oh, that's really beautiful. I'm so glad that you got to that place. And I guess I really appreciate the process that you worked through to get there. And it's interesting, for me as a kid, I was labeled as the calming child. So like I was always in my report cards, I had a calming influence on others. And for me, I think for a long time, I interpreted that as like, oh, I was really boring. But it's been really interesting to just kind of play with that over the years. It's like, huh, you know, as a psychologist, that's largely my role, is to help people regulate. So it's just funny how our childhood personas, who we are, just is who we are.
And yet I hear you saying you really claimed that and you share that so beautifully.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, but it took a while too, because it's like, oh, boring. That sounds terrible. But, you know, perception. So dig into courage a little bit more. This is actually something that I've heard a lot of women leaders just kind of speak to or even name out loud, like that courage is really a strong value for them. But I don't necessarily hear everybody in our culture or even majority of leaders talking about that. Why do you think courage is so fundamental for women leaders in particular?
That's such a good question. So I think we have to just think about what courage is and where it shows up. And then I think it, you know, becomes really clear why it's important in leadership. And then look at what happens for women in particular, because it's different for us. So I went way back, as far back as I could go, to look into the history of courage. Thousands of years. This is talked about in literally all major texts where we look at things that have to do with leading people. So in, you know, you go back to Aristotle, and there's conversations with Aristotle and Athenian generals talking about courage, and that they knew that it was required, but they didn't know how to describe it. There was no language that they could put around it, but what they were certain of is that it had to be present in leadership. And I saw this same trend. I don't know how to describe it. I can't actually tell you exactly what it is, but I know it's a foundational requirement. And this goes through even into today, into our high reliability systems and healthcare. When you look at that, you can go into the white papers and they will say, you must have courage. They won't tell you how to get it, though, because it's not really well understood how to get it. There wasn't a map. And then, but really when you think about, like, why is courage needed? Well, because courage shows up in places of change, right? It really, when we don't know how to do something, that's where courage shows up, right? So we don't have confidence in it. We don't have competence. That's where courage shows up. It shows up where harm exists, and it shows up where shame exists. Then there's those combinations, right? So we put harm and shame together. Now you're looking at oppression, all kinds of things. But it's really in those places where we feel that vulnerability is what we're going to have to walk through. So that definition, deliberately choosing what's right for you in the face of risk, uncertainty, and emotional exposure, or what Brené Brown would call risk, uncertainty, emotional exposure equals vulnerability. And though I wasn't able to use her research in mine when I first started in my dissertation, it was the same. All of the researchers that I had looked in their past work, and all of the women that I sat with in their stories, told me the same thing. So when we think about that, that's where it shows up. That's where leadership shows up too, right? Where we now have to lead people into places we haven't been before, or where we have to make change, or where things look and feel and will experience vulnerability. And that's why I think it's really important, you know, that we've started to hear vulnerability start to, you know, creep into the language in leadership. And this is why it's so important, because that's where, you know, that's where things, that's where we need our leaders to show us the way, that it's okay, that we don't have to know all the answers. Then you look at women, and what we found, or what I found in the research for women, is that this interesting thing happens for us when we are young. So for boys who enter into adolescence, they tend to rise or stay the same in their courage. For girls, that is not the case. Girls largely will start to lose their voice in being able to speak up or say what they feel like is right for them, and they'll largely lose their courage. Like 70% of girls Wow. report this. And when I ask my women participants about it, they said, yes, absolutely, and I didn't learn how to get it back until I was in midlife. So I think we hear a lot about this, or starting to hear more about this from women of, yes, that's important. And it's also something that we don't teach in school necessarily. We certainly aren't teaching this in leadership development yet. And so that's one of the things that I'm really, you know, stand in the gap for women for, is that change in, let's equip women with the map. Let's and maybe further and later down the road, I would love to look at, you know, what it would mean to equip girls with the map for choosing courage.
I mean, it sounds like it's so clear that courage is almost innate, but it's really influenced by our socialization and then by the environments later. And the way that you described those environmental factors made me think of women, you know, where there's harm, where there's pain, where there's transition and change, and where there's wrongs. You know, I mean, women are just constantly in those spaces. So it doesn't surprise me that women would get it back or at some point, you know, kind of come full circle. But that's a long road to like make it through those harms, perhaps, before they get there.
Yes, absolutely.
So what does that courage map look like? What does it mean to, you know, be able to follow a map or have a courage cartographer to guide you?
So there's really four pillars. I think that's the best way I would describe it. Four pillars. And they're not weighted equally. There are two main pillars that, above all other things, are really required. Now, we can have different levels of them and different types or not necessarily types of courage, but different instances of courage might require we have different levels of these pillars at different times. And it's what makes courage, one of the things that makes it so difficult to really get to is because all instances are not the same. We can have giant moments of courage that take a lot for us to summon that courage. And we can have small everyday moments where it doesn't take quite as much. But the two main pillars, and then I'll talk about the other two, the two main pillars are belonging to self and belief in self. And belonging to self is, I would say, one of the things that is a little more difficult for people to really understand because we are such social creatures. That it is that I have acceptance of myself, radical acceptance of myself, that I know how to show myself compassion, how to love myself. I understand my worthiness. I'm clear on my values and I know how to own my voice. And that particular pillar is so important because the deal with courage is you may have people around you also choosing the same courage you are, but no one can do it for you. It is a very personal experience. And so others may be rooting for you and on your, you know, like on your team, and others may also be choosing alongside of you. But no one can choose for you. You must walk that path alone. And while you're walking it, courage doesn't show up in places where everybody else is doing it. That's just a lovely place, you know? Courage shows up in this place where you really are saying that whatever else is happening, this is different than that. So when you think about change, right? Whatever else has been happening, that's not what we're doing anymore. And now I'm going to walk into something that is unknown or different. And so while you're walking through that place, there's no one else that you can belong to because you singularly are going to have to be able to stand firm even when you might hear from others what you're doing is wrong, not okay, whatever that looks like. I think about, when I think about an example of that, I think about the physician who raised the flag in Flint, Michigan for the water issue, right? And so when she did that, there was all of these voices that started to come and say, you're wrong, your data's wrong, all of these things that challenge that. And she had to stand firm in her own self. She had to belong to herself to not back down from that place. So that belonging to self is is one of the most critical pieces of courage. Right next to that is belief in self. So those look a little bit different. Belief in self is that willingness to be vulnerable, right? Because we have to walk through it. And so it's my willingness to do that. And this is where your trust in yourself comes up. So can I trust myself with the choices that I'm going to make and with the actions I need to take? And that trust, trust is one of those other things that we don't always understand how to get it or how to choose that and what it looks like. And so that's one of the things that's, you know, really important in teaching is what does trust look like and how do you know if you're able, you know, or if you are developing that with yourself and how do you get experience with it and trusting yourself? It's also belief in self is an acceptance of failure. Like I can accept that I might fall down and falling down is going to be okay because I belong to myself and I believe in myself. I'm going to be able to get back up and keep going and dust myself off and it's going to be okay. And then there's an ownership. I chose this for very specific reasons, right? That's why courage is defined as deliberately choosing what's right in the face of, because it is a personal choice. It's a personal experience, even when it's in a big public way, or you're going along with other people making that choice too. It is still very personal to you. And then there's in belief in self, there's a part I tried really hard to code out and will tell you because I was like, I don't know how that shows up or I'm not sure what that means. And there were lots of definitions around it. And so I had to reframe the definition of faith. Because I couldn't quite understand, and I had in my mind just that, you know, very like dogma style of faith. That's what was in my mind, and I didn't understand how that showed up. But what I found is that is the way in which some move through faith, but not all. And it's really not what faith meant in the research. But it showed up in every single woman's interview, every single one. They said things like, it's like a leap of faith over and over. And what I found that they meant is faith is that there is a possible positive future, not a guarantee, just possible. It's just possible. The other two pillars are critical reflection. And critical doesn't mean like being a critic. It means really creating a safe container for yourself where you can get curious and honest and open, and that you can explore the options that exist inside of the action that really has to occur, and that you can trust your intuition. Intuition for women was incredibly profound in their process of being in reflection with themselves. And then there's this embracing of discomfort that you can kind of lean into. You don't need to make it go away. That you can experience discomfort and be okay there and know that it's just discomfort, right? It's not when those uncomfortable feelings or unpleasant feelings come up, that that's not going to harm me, but that there's something there for me to learn from. And it was interesting in critical reflection. Sometimes women will invite others into this space. So they might call a friend or talk to a colleague. But one thing that is certain is that that place always is required for them to really move forward in a way that is honoring of their values. And then lastly, and this one is, it was incredibly important, and women do many things to create this space. But I did see instances where courage does happen, where this didn't exist, but those places were way more difficult. And that is the fourth pillar of supportive connections. And so women really move towards looking for those supportive connections. So support from important relationships, and those relationships shift. That looks different depending on what type of courage they are or what instance of courage they are reaching for. So if they're reaching for, maybe they're leaving a relationship that was abusive. I heard a lot of stories about that and how much they would reach for these connections and they weren't always in the places that they would hope. So maybe not with a, sometimes they would say, you know, their parents didn't agree, or their friends or whatever, but those weren't the places then. So it's support from important relationships of the courage choice. And then, where they can be in community with other women who are also taking courageous action. So that shared experience, and then mentors and vicarious learning. And so we think about, we go back to those girls in adolescence who lose their ability to summon courage. And we think about, you know, vicarious learning can actually teach us how to reach for courage. To me, it's like, ooh, there's such a gap in that place, and a place that could really, we could build a bridge. But also for our women leaders, when we look at leadership development, you know, leadership development for women so that we can build a bridge.
So, it just seems like it's pretty clear, really, how you can help women walk through this process. And as you were sharing that process, I could identify with a situation that I experienced in a professional setting where I thought, okay, there's harm being done. I need to do something about it. And I felt a little bit like the little redhead, like running around to different people to talk about what was going on. Like, hey, will you help me? Will you come with me? And like, they all agreed, but only one person was willing to stand with me. And her support was, you know, it meant the world. And I think it empowered me to take that step that I needed to take. But I was so surprised, and maybe naively so, that nobody else was willing to stand up, even though I know these people shared the same concerns. So, you know, it's just so interesting to be in those places. So how do you help women to like embody this or use this map and maybe even have the courage and the faith to do so, to walk into this new direction or this new journey?
First, I want to acknowledge what you were just sharing, and that really looking for supportive connections, right? How important that is to us, but also that it is a choice we make on our own, right? Because I think one of the most misunderstood things about courage is what the opposite of courage is. You know, we have heard for so long that the opposite of courage is cowardice. And that is such a shame-based word that was derived to really get people motivated in a shame-based way to do things that's not natural. So if you think about a long time ago, right, maybe the Roman Empire, the army was going to descend on this farming community. And now we've gone and told the bread maker and the farmer and the blacksmith and their children, pick up swords and go fight these soldiers, right? This is not normal for us to behave in that way. The normal thing whatever normal is, but the way we're wired is for self-protection. Our brain is wired for survival, not for courage, confidence, not for accuracy. It is wired for survival and self-protection. And so really cowardice came as a way to say, well, if you don't, then, right, then you are this label, you are this thing, and that makes you bad. And we really can't tolerate that. And so we go and do a thing. And I think that that's a really important thing in courage, to see that difference, that that's not what that is. The opposite of courage is the way we're wired. The opposite of courage is self-protection. And so it doesn't surprise me that those other folks didn't come alongside, because there has to be, they have to, one, know how to summon the courage. And there has to be a bigger yes to courage than their yes to self-protection. And I think it's really important that we, when we're having conversations around courage, that we understand that we're all in different places of what we are able to do and what is at stake in protection, right? That it's pretty natural for us to protect if I'm the sole breadwinner and in doing this thing means I think what I'm risking is my job and now my children's life, you know, their life and all of the other things that it comes behind what my salary means, right? That's huge. And so self-protection is a pretty expected experience. So I just think that that's really important for us to understand when we're talking about courage. And then we look at ways that that I help and with this map is to help women build those places within themselves so that when they need to summon their courage, when their yes needs to be bigger than self-protection, that they have the tools and skills to do it. So we look at, you know, what is my purpose? How do I get clarity on what my sacred gifts are and what it is that I've come to do in this world? And what are the values that drive me so that I understand that when I feel like I need to summon my courage, that sometimes what's creating that is that values insult. And how do I get clear on what that looks like so that I can respond instead of react to whatever the situation is that's going on? And then I can be in that self-reflective place in a really healthy, meaningful way. We look at what it looks like to own our voice. How do I? What if I'm not used to speaking up? How do I decide when speaking up is the thing I want to choose? And, you know, and if I'm someone who is used to staying quiet, or maybe I've been told over and over, right? This is kind of how that happens, is we've heard those messages over and over. And that I saw that so clearly in the women's research, where women hear these messages throughout their lives of be more ladylike. You're being too bossy. You're too pushy. You're for African American women, they told me that they hear messages of angry Black woman. You're just an angry Black woman. And it's like, you know, so we hear all of these unwanted identities. And that's where we, you know, we use those tools like name, reframe, and claim those experiences so that we can shift those places where we've been told that we're too loud, we're too bossy, we're too whatever, or the not enoughs, right? That you're not smart enough, you're not in the club, you're not whatever it is that you're not enough of, that we can really start to slough that off and get to the real authentic self that exists and love all of her. And so, you know, all of the tools along the way do that. And then they're also set up where at the beginning, women get clear on their purpose and what actions they want to take so that they have something tangible to work with. And we're not just, you know, working from this place of that's all nice and good, but that they can really practice it in very practical ways in their lives and take actions and start to get some results and some success. Because we don't always want to set encourage, right? What we'd really like to experience is confidence and competence. And we can develop confidence and competence around how to summon courage as well. And I think those are the places where, you know, we really focus on how do we get you enough experience with these tools that when you need this in a bigger courage way, that you know what to do.
Sounds really empowering. And what I also heard in there when you were talking about connecting women with values and purpose, for me, how that translated was like changing what women are trying to protect so that that human urge for self-protection of maybe physical things or physical safety, family, sort of broadens and comes to extend to our own identity or what's most important to us. And for me, I guess that was a really powerful moment hearing you describe that, because initially I was thinking like, well, how do you get women to like essentially turn their back on what's human? But what I heard from you is like, how do we help women fully embrace who they are and then be willing to stand up for that? And that's really different.
It is. It is very different. Yeah, we can't turn our backs on who we are. We actually have to love all of that. We have to claim all of who we are. And that there's really no judgment around, you know, either one of those choices, wherever we are, that's going to be different based on the circumstance. And what I've found to be true is when something is really important to women, when they've decided, this is what's important to me, and they choose courage, it didn't matter if the outcome was positive or not. That what they told me, and I should clarify that some women were in situations that, you know, sometimes courage shows up in places that are dangerous. And when they chose courage, even when the outcomes were not good and dangerous things did happen, they did not regret their choice. Because what's on the other side of courage is freedom, empowerment, and relief. Those are the outcomes of courage. Having said that, that's not a plug for going out and doing dangerous things either. But that's what makes it, it's a very personal experience. And wherever we are is okay. And when women are ready, we're ready to help.
And women certainly can't always pick their environment or their circumstances. So being prepared to deal with them and interact with them, I think is so empowering. And I, you know, on a personal level with that story I shared earlier, I really identified with that outcome of freedom. Because for me, I think I came to the point where I felt like my integrity is so compromised if I do nothing that I'm, you know, I'm becoming a slave to my environment or my circumstances or people with more power who are making decisions. And I can't stand for that. So for me, it was like, whatever happens, like, sure, I could lose my job or I could just have a toxic environment, but I'm going to feel so much better about who I am. And that was really true. And, you know, there wasn't anything terrible that happened either. But I think for me, it would have been terrible had I done nothing, because I think that would have been really corrosive for me.
So what you're speaking to is the same types of thing that I found, that when women felt moved to courage, like how you felt moved to courage, when they didn't act on it, the outcomes of that were chronic emotional wounds, not scars, wounds. They did not heal. And it led to increased suppression of their self, their voice. It led them to feeling even less powerful. So, you know, there was a powerlessness that they experienced as well. And so, yeah, I definitely, that resonates with what I heard from other women is, you know, there's the choice, right? There's the courage choice of what happens if, what's the cost if I don't choose?
So I'm curious how you apply courage, particularly to women working in healthcare settings. And I know you have extraordinary amount of experience in many healthcare settings and systems. But I guess for me, so much of what happens in healthcare on a daily basis can go against our core values or what we think is right. And, you know, and I know there are no easy answers, but how do you go beyond like principles of high reliability or, you know, these big principles that our institutions say we believe in. And as women leaders, actually, you know, bring our courage into these really difficult, complex, dangerous sometimes situations?
That's such a good question. And there isn't an easy answer to it. One of the things I think about often in healthcare in particular, because it's been the lens I've lived in for so many decades at this point, is we talk a lot about that we have to build psychological safety, right? We hear this all the time, that they set psychological safety as a foundation for where we can provide safe healthcare. And I believe that to be true, that psychological safety is the key to where we can have safe, reliable care. Because where we have psychological safety, we are safe to speak up, right? I can say, hey, I don't think that this is the right decision, or I see XYZ and I want to advocate for whatever this patient needs, or maybe whatever the staff needs too, because I think both of those are important. What is not understood in psychological safety is where it exists, we don't have these issues, right? This isn't a problem. Courage is not really needed, or not needed in these major ways where psychological safety exists. The issue really comes in of how do we start to build collective courage in organizations where psychological safety doesn't exist? Because that's where things get dangerous, right? Where I don't feel like I can speak up without harm or some type of risk, uncertainty, or emotional exposure happening in my world. And this is what's not really understood in organizations, is when we look at when we go into an organization and we look at maybe their all employee scores or something, whatever they use, and we see that there's these low levels of trust, there's low levels of feeling safe to speak up, all of those types of things. What we typically do, we'll start to shift and say, oh, well, we have to create a culture of safety. So we have to tell everybody how psychological safety happens, what it looks like, and how you are to behave. But the fact of the matter is, what we haven't addressed is that that's where courage exists. Those are courageous choices, and you're asking your employees to summon courage in a system that courage is actually what's needed because they might experience something adverse. When really the shift is that those things have to occur in places that starts well above that frontline employee, right? It's not actually a reasonable request of an organization to ask frontline employees to have significant amounts of courage while they don't, or while they haven't created a place where summoning courage doesn't lead to retaliation, right? It doesn't lead to harm in your professional harm. Maybe what I often heard was being ousted from a department or a position or whatever those things are. And so when I see those things, my conversations start at the top. They must. Because again, courage is a vicarious learning experience as well, right? It requires mentorship and vicarious learning. And that has to come from whoever's setting the rules. And when we think about like how an organization, how the culture grows, it grows from our top leaders down, right? And that doesn't mean that there can't be pockets. There are, but they overall can't be sustained for long periods of time outside of those pockets, organizationally as a culture. And so in healthcare, where I see those, my conversations are at the top and starting to have conversations on what does it mean to set a foundation where psychological safety can exist. and those things are going to look like that the leader is exhibiting their own courageous behaviors, where they are showing us that if I fail or make a mistake, it's okay, right? That's a courageous act for a leader to take, to be able to demonstrate that and let their selves be seen in that place where they're having their own audacious failure experiences, right? And that they're not hiding it, that they're showing that this is okay, and that they're building trust. So you do what you say you're going to do. You set appropriate boundaries and you hold them. That there's not tolerance for these harmful experiences. And when people start to see their leaders behave in that way, they will start to take their own small courageous risks. And where they do have successes, or at the very least, they're not shamed, come to harm, or required to change their behavior, others will start to go, oh, well, you were successful at doing that. Maybe I'll do that with you, right? I'll do the next thing with you. And we start to get curious. And it's in this curiosity where you can see me doing something and I have been held in a safe container by my leadership. This is where the magic starts to happen, because now we start to develop collective courage. In collective courage, now you start to have frontline employees who come together with ideas of how we can make things better, right? Now we start to solve for our inefficiencies, because I know it's okay. And you know it's okay. And we start to do this on our own. Well, here's the other cool thing that happens with that. Now we start to, that's where we start to really develop experience with courage, which moves us towards competence and confidence. And so as we're doing that, we start to move out of this place of needing so much courage, because that's where we've really built this place of psychological safety. Courage is something we don't actually want our organizations to need a ton of, because it means we haven't made it safe enough for them. When we have, and we start to move into that place, this is where synergy happens. And if we're really lucky, it's where innovation happens, because employees start to hold each other in accountability. We start to bring one another up, raise each other. Come with me. I'll show you the way. Come check out this cool thing. I want you to be on this team, right? We can solve for, we can have closed loop conversation. We can say, hey, I made a mistake. We can say, hey, I don't think that that's a great way for our patient to move forward, but what about this, this, or this? And we can start to have these really collaborative conversations, as opposed to staying quiet and being afraid and really needing to stay in self-protection. So we move out of that place of self-protection and really move into a place of synergy.
Wow. That just honestly gives me goosebumps to hear that whole.
Doesn't that sound like a lovely place to work? Like, this is the place, right?
Sign me up. Oh, it sounds so amazing. And it's a place of struggle, because I know I work with teams and leaders and of varying levels in different departments and organizations. And one of the challenges I run into is at times I'll have a senior tier or like just below this chief executive tier of leaders who I'm working with. And we're having conversations and it's like they are not comfortable going all the way to the top to get whoever is actually on top involved in this process. And it's so painful. Like it stunts growth, it stunts progress, and I think it really stunts psychological safety. And I love that community-based courage that you're describing. That is just beautiful. So anyway, I just want to name that is something I see as a struggle for folks. And I think they often do have courage and they're doing what they can. And it's not always safe to go all the way up. So is there a time where, you saw this work, or you saw success at that highest level and saw the transformation that came down after the top leaders did completely take ownership of courage and create that organizational safety in this way.
Yeah, I mean, along the path of doing this work, I've seen this more than once. I'm very happy to say that I've seen this in many different industries as well. So in the healthcare industry, where I saw this conversation, and it was at the top, CEO of hospital, and going and introducing an idea to say, here's what we're seeing. Here's what the employees are saying. Not safe, right? Don't feel like I can speak up. And by the way, patient outcomes, not so great. We think these two things are related. Let us try this path, this progression that I described, which means it starts with you. Are you on board? And the CEO said, yes, because I want better for my employees and I want better for my patients. And so they got right on board. That was the key. That right there, right? Our top leaders owe to their frontline employees to lower the barrier to courage, lower the how high they have to climb with their courage. That is their responsibility as leaders, is to not create a barrier that is so high and difficult that employees give up because they can't move it far enough or it's too unsafe, right? And so when we did that and that leader said yes, we started working with that leader on all of those things we just talked about in their behaviors. And when their behaviors started to, they started to see the shift and started to make some connections of, oh, I understand my values. I understand how my values are showing up here. And I understand that other people don't know this about me, right? And we started to make clear and transparent the way in which decisions were made and their behaviors were coming through. And they were vulnerable enough to say, I'm trying this thing. I want to see if it makes a difference. And then you take the next steps, right? And also now what we're going to do is we're going to demonstrate through my behaviors that yes, you can in fact have ideas that maybe have been outside of what's our cultural norm is. And I'm going to hold this space and I'm going to make it safe for you to do it. And that happened. And as that happened, these incredible results started to happen. We were measuring employee perception every quarter. Employee perception dipped for a moment, which is natural, because they were like, I don't really know if this is safe, right? I don't know if I believe you. And through those first people who were courageous enough to say, okay, I'll try, right? We started to build collective courage through their experience, and we started to see their perception rise. And it, I mean, on a Likert scale of 5, it went from like 2s, right, in the highly disagreeable to high 4s, nearly as high as you could go on, yes, I believe that this organization is behind me. I am safe here. I can speak up. I have decisional involvement, all the things. That shifted, and about 6 months later, we saw the patient outcomes shift, and you could match them along the shift of the employee perception and the patient outcomes and the patient satisfaction scores. They mirrored one another, but about 6 months later. And as those things stayed in alignment, that progress stayed. When that change shifted, progress went back. I've also seen this, though, in other industries. I worked with an accounting firm. That leader, the owner of the firm, was on it, wanted all these things. Guess what she got? All these things. And I think that's so important to know this was a woman leader, because the things that are not known about women leader is where you have women on the boards, especially in healthcare organizations, you see higher levels of financial stability. You see an increase where women leaders exist, an increase in diversity and innovation because the diversity is inclusive. And you also start to see a higher level of empathy and compassion across the organization. People start to care about people more and be okay with expressing that and make decisions from that collective humanity.
That's so affirming, I think, for women, you know, to identify with and connect with who we are on an innate level. So thank you for sharing that. Well, my last question for you is just, what keeps you connected with joy as you do this work?
What keeps me connected is when I see women transforming. I see the aha moments, the successes. I love to tell my clients stories and their successes because they're gorgeous. And like, I am all in for that. Where I see that, it's like, yes, well, I want more. Like, I want more of that success for women.
Thank you so much, Lucy. Thank you for sharing just this really, I know my mind is just going 100 million miles an hour and I just love it. So thank you.
Thank you. It was such a good time. It was so good. It's like my heart feels full.
Mine too. Such an honor. Thank you for listening to Menders. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with a friend. And don't forget to head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com to get started creating cultural transformation for your healthcare team today. Let's create transformation magic.